Fittingly, similar to how baseball's slow tension defies the modern demand for action at all costs, baseball's most enduring song has endured America's constant shift in mood. The Star-Spangled Banner became a baseball institution in the 1918 World Series between the Boston Red Sox and Chicago Cubs. With the nation deep into World War I, enthusiasm for the fall classic ebbed. To stoke the Chicago crowd in Game 1, a military band played the Marshall song in the eighth inning. The crowd's energy soared. When the series shifted to Boston, the anthem became part of the pregame ceremony. Play ball. Let's join in a thought experiment now. What might it have been like to have been in the stands at League Park in Cleveland in one of the 1920 World Series games taking place between the Cleveland Indians and the Brooklyn Dodgers? Before the first pitch, brass bands were warming up near the third base grandstand. Cornet scales were heard, snare drum taps, a tuba's low hum. Vendors were shouting, "Peanuts, popcorn, ice cold soda." Fans were actually singing snatches of "Take Me Out to the Ball Game" on their own, but it wasn't an organized tradition yet. A band plays a march by Sousa or Pryor, something bright and brassy to stir the crowd. The crack of bats as players take ball practice, echoing off the wooden grandstand roof. Murmured excitement about the respective team managers, Tris Speaker and Duster Mails, and the Brooklyn Dodgers. Then, the first inning. A sharp, clean crack as the first pitch is hit. Wood on horsehide is the loudest sound in the park. The crowd reacts in a single wave. No amplification, just 10,000 plus voices rising at once. Between batters, the band plays short, jaunty riffs, ragtime influenced, upbeat, not tied to specific players. Umpire calls "strike" are loud and nasal, carrying surprisingly far into the open air. Vendors move through the aisles, "cigars, fresh cigars." A distant streetcar bell rings outside the park. League Park sat right in a city neighborhood. A band plays a waltz or sentimental tune, something from Tin Pan Alley that the crowd recognizes. Fans chatter constantly. Baseball in 1920 is a social event as much as a sporting one. Now, the third inning. A big defensive play brings a roar that builds from the lower grandstand upward, rolling like a wave. The band responds with a triumphant march. Kids in the bleachers start their own chants, rhythmic clapping, not organized cheers. The smell of roasted peanuts and cigar smoke thickens. The fourth inning. A lull in scoring means quieter moments. The thump of the catcher's mitt, the umpire's bark, the murmur of fans debating strategy. The band plays a softer tune, maybe a popular ballad of the day. A vendor bell rings as he sells bottled soda. Now we're in the fifth inning. This is where the 1920 series famously produced historic plays. So imagine a sudden explosion of sound as a home run or big hit lands, fans stomping wooden floors, creating a deep drumming resonance underfoot. The band launches into its loudest march yet, trying to be heard over the frenzy. Fans shout individual encouragements. No coordinated chants, just raw emotion. The game settles again in the sixth inning. The band plays a medley of popular tunes, maybe a jazz-tinged number reflecting the era's tastes. A vendor with a deep voice calls out, "Scorecards! Get your cards! Scorecards!" The crack of the bat echoes sharply in the cooler late afternoon air. Now we're in the seventh inning, and as of yet in baseball, there's no formal stretch tradition. But fans naturally stand, stretch, and talk. Some sing Take Me Out to the Ball Game on their own. Others hum it ad hoc, and the band plays a lively rag or foxtrot, music of the Roaring Twenties creeping into the ballpark. Now, as we arrive at the eighth inning, tension rises. The crowd becomes more reactive, less chatty. Every pitch draws a gasp or groan. The band plays shorter, sharper bursts, anticipatory, energetic. The wooden grandstand creaks as fans lean forward in unison. The ninth inning. The crowd is at full volume, a living, breathing roar. Bender stops selling. Everyone is watching. The band holds back until the final out, then erupts into a triumphant march as Cleveland leads. Fans cheer, hats thrown in the air, the sound echoing off the neighborhood buildings outside the park. That's what it might have sounded like for Game 7 that was played on Tuesday, October 12th. And it was a sunny day with clear skies, temperatures rising into the 70s, a frenzied crowd of 27,525 fans packed League Park, marking the largest attendance of any single game of the 1920 World Series. The contest featured two spitball pitchers, Stan Kovaleski for Cleveland and Burley Grimes for Brooklyn. Both Kovaleski and Grimes were perfect through the first two innings. Stan gave up the first hit of the game in the top of the third when, with one out, Grimes beat out a grounder to shortstop Joe Sewell. Cleveland scored their first run in the bottom of the fourth when Larry Gardner, with one out, hit a hard ground ball just past second base for a single. The game continued as pitcher Al Mamo relieved Grimes in the bottom of the eighth and retired the Indians in order, setting the stage for the climactic ninth inning. The hometown crowd took to their feet, pinning their hopes on Covey as he jogged to the mound. Stan retired leadoff hitter Tommy Griffith on a fly ball to left field for the first out. Zach Wheat followed with a base hit to center, but was retired on a fielder's choice. We had Brooklyn's last hope as the first baseman, who smashed a hard grounder to Sewell, who ended the game with a flip to Wambi at second base, and for a solitary moment, time seemed to stop. All the years of losing, all the last place finishes, the eternal frustration that had been passed down from one generation of fans to the next, now belonged to the history books. Amid all the tears, laughter, and jubilation was the realization that the Cleveland Indians had finally won their very first world championship. Thousands of euphoric fans swarmed the field to congratulate their heroes, who sprinted for the clubhouse to avoid chaos. That is, except for Stan Kovaleski, who ambled off the diamond. That from a new biography of pitcher Stan Kovaleski by William Cachetus, titled Spitballer, Stan Kovaleski and the 1920 Cleveland Indians, issued by the University of Nebraska Press. Dr. Cachetus was born in Wilkes-Barre. He has strong ties to northeastern Pennsylvania. He is an American historian, educator, and author known for his expertise in Quaker history, the Underground Railroad, and early American baseball. And he joined us here at the WVIA studios to introduce us to Kobe, as he was called, and to talk with us about this remarkable player who began as a breaker boy at the Luke Fiddler Colliery in Shamokin, Pennsylvania. In part two of our conversation, Dr. Cachetus talks about the tragic loss of Kobe's first wife, Mary, in May of 1920, early in the season, that would culminate in what Dr. Cachetus suggests was Kobe's World Series.
After the season's over, because the season ends in October, Stan would come back to Shamokin and assume more responsibility for his sons, but Francis would take care of him as well. And he finally mustered up the courage to ask her to marry him. And obviously they had a longer marriage, and she really doted on him. The sons were like her own children. So yes, she became a baseball wife, you know, widow during the season and wife year round. Also, like her sister, more gregarious and complimented Stan.
What was the nickname they gave to him?
The Silent Pole. The newspapers, I mean, this is not a politically correct time period. They called him the Pollock in the newspapers. You know, imagine saying something like that today. But yes, the sports writers, national sports writers, would call him the Silent Pole, which was a reflection of his reservedness. And he wasn't a really big man either. He was probably about 5'11" and 166 pounds. So he wasn't a power pitcher. He wasn't a strikeout guy. Although he could get a strikeout when he needed it, he was more of a finesse pitcher. He had control so he could locate his pitches. And according to him, he could even locate the spitball, which is hard to believe, but he claims that he could do that. Very quiet guy, though, very quiet.
Tell us about, in the overall world of baseball, the various teams and so forth, what was the standing, and I don't necessarily mean third from the bottom or number one, of the Cleveland Indians? Who were their fans? What were they known for?
Cleveland has an interesting baseball history. There were several incarnations of the Cleveland Indians before they came about. There were the Four Cities. That was one of the first teams, which played in the, I guess, 1860s or 1870s. Then they had the Cleveland Spiders, because the uniforms that they had and the nature of the players, who were long-limbed, reminded them of spiders. The name Indian came in allegedly because they signed a Native American Indian by the name of Louis Sockalexis. He was a Penobscot Indian, and he could do it all, at least for two seasons, before he became an alcoholic. And that was the end of his career. So allegedly, the name Indian came from that. But it's more like the Boston Braves. They were called the Miracle Braves because they came out of nowhere to win the World Series against the world champion Philadelphia Athletics in 1914. And since the whole mascot of an Indian seemed to be popular, Cleveland sports writers took on that and started calling them the Spiders, to calling them the Indians. But Cleveland did not have a very good team. I mean, they were bottom dwellers for many years. They really started to build a winner in 1916, and that's when Kovalevsky came up with them. Their two star pitchers from 1916 to pretty much 1922 were Jim Bagby. He was the ace. It wasn't Kovalevsky. Kovalevsky was the number two pitcher. For example, 1920, Bagby won 31 games, whereas Covey won 24. He led the league in strikeouts, ironically, with 133 for a guy who wasn't really trying to strike batters out, but he was the number two pitcher. And they also had Tris Speaker, who was considered one of the greatest baseball players of all time. And Speaker built that team. He got a lot of players from his old Boston Red Sox team to come over. And the Red Sox were a very good team. I mean, in the 1910s, they were like the class of the American League. So with Tris Speaker, they really built Cleveland into a winning program. And of course, that really kind of culminated in 1920 with them winning their first World Series.
And we read about the role that Stan played in that winning of the World Series that year.
Right. And that World Series, his performance in that World Series is among the top performances in all of baseball history. I mean, think about this. It was supposed to be a 9-game series back in the day. Cleveland won it in 7. Kovalevsky pitched in game 1, game 4, I think it was game 4, and game 7. He won all 3 games. He won the first one 3-1, he won the second one 5-1, and he won the last one 3-0, a shutout. He only gave up 5 hits in each one of the games. He averaged 78 pitches. That's unheard of. I mean, 78 pitches, man, some of the major league pitchers today get that in 3 innings. I mean, an average of 78 pitches. So he was the 6th pitcher in the history of baseball to win 3 complete games in a single World Series. Chrissy Mathewson had done it in 1905. Bill Dineen did it for Boston in 1903. Jack Combs did it for the Philadelphia Athletics in 1910. Smokey Joe Wood did it for the Boston Red Sox, I think, in 1912. There was one other pitcher, and here comes Covey, the sixth one. And do you know, just to tell you how bad baseball's dropped off, the last person, there's only been 10 that have done that, won three complete games in one World Series. There's only 10 that have done that in the history of the game. The last one to do it was Mickey Lolich of the Detroit Tigers in 1968. You can't even get a complete game out of any of these pitchers anymore. These days, you face four pitchers in a game. You face the starter, a middle reliever, a setup man, and the closer. The complete game is gone. You know, no one throws complete games. You know, that's gone. The last time we had that routinely was in the 1970s. To me, that just shows how poor the pitching is in Major League Baseball today. And the coaching. The coaching's horrendous. Everybody's got to throw 100 miles an hour. Everybody's got to strike out every batter. That's not baseball. I don't know what that is. That's a joke.
What was so sportsmanlike about Covey?
He never bragged, never trash talked, very quiet. He walked off that field after he won that seventh game of the World Series like it was just another day at work. And it wasn't until Billy Evans, one of the umpires, came and told him, "Do you realize what you just did?" And then he said, because he had given all the credit to his catcher, Steve O'Neill. And then finally he said, "Yeah, I guess it was pretty exceptional." And that was it. That was it. Now, because of his performance, Sonny Jim Dunn, the cheapskate owner of the Cleveland Indians, raised Covey's salary from $4,000 to $5,000 for 1921. But, you know, Covey was really swimming in the money because the cut that each player got for the winning the 1920 World Series was $4,300. So for winning the series, his salary was kind of doubled. And then he got the extra $1,000 for 1921.
What was the journey he took to the Hall of Fame, and why was it so long?
His career stats were 215 wins, 141 losses. He never got 1,000 strikeouts. It was like 980, 981 strikeouts. He had a 2.49, I think, maybe 2.59 ERA, earned run average. Compared to most of the guys who got in the Hall of Fame back in those days, they were 300 game winners. And they were strikeout people, and they were power pitchers. Stan was none of those. He was none of those. And, you know, he had that one World Series. I mean, he pitched for the Washington Senators in 1925, who, by the way, were managed by another anthracite product, Bucky Harris. It's one of the reasons why Bucky Harris wanted Kovalevsky on his team, because he was from northeastern Pennsylvania and he could relate with him. But Stan pitched in the 1925 World Series. The big pitcher for Washington at that time was Walter Johnson, a power pitcher. And Stan was the number two pitcher, but he lost both of the games that he won. So, you know, he wasn't in and out of the World Series like a lot of these other guys did, as impressive as the one, you know, World Series that he did have. So all of those reasons, the writers didn't put him in. So his candidacy is usually the case. After you're off the writer's ballot, you go to the Veterans Committee. So, you know, it took him, he retired in 1928. So he was eligible, I think, for the first time in 1933 for the Hall of Fame from the writer's ballot. And then he got knocked off the writer's ballot, I think, in the 1940s. So from the 1940s to 1969, that's when he got in, 1969. So finally, when the Hall of Fame called South Bend to speak to Covey, he was out fishing, as usual. He had a gas station, too. You know, he had a gas station in South Bend, and he also gave pitching tips to the little leaguers out in back of the garage. What kind of guy does that today? What kind of major league player does that today? But he was out fishing, and his wife, Frances, took the call. And she was at first speechless, and then when she finally found the word, she said, "Well, it's about time." And she also said, you know, if Stanley had gotten this honor after he died, I would not have gone to the ceremony. Okay, so 69, he died in 1984. So what? You know, he had 15 years. He had 15 years to enjoy it. And you feel bad for a guy like Dick Allen, who really had, you know, a stellar career. He never got to enjoy it.
And you also tell us that Kohei and Francis used to go.
Oh, yeah. That was a command performance. Every summer, the Hall of Fame induction is usually at the end of July. So their son, their younger son, Jack, passed away of rheumatic fever like a couple days after he graduated from high school. And he's buried here in Shamokin. Bill, the older boy, also, I think, died in his 50s of a heart attack. But Bill would drive them all the way from South Bend, and they'd stop off at Shamokin, then head up to Cooperstown, turn around, come back through Shamokin, and then back to South Bend. That was a standard, that was a routine trip for them every single summer in July.
I'm watching you across the table, and you were showing me how the spitball works and how he might have held the ball, and talking about the fact that he insisted that he could control the ball. Was there anything artful about the way he pitched? He wasn't a power pitcher. You used the word maybe finesse. Is there anything to complement the power nature of many of the players?
Well, pitchers, basically, you're either a power pitcher, and everybody wants to be a power pitcher today, or you're a control pitcher. You know, you work the strike zone. You paint the corners of the strike zone, so to speak. Usually what happens is a power pitcher, as he ages, becomes more of a finesse pitcher. But you do have some guys like Greg Maddux of the Braves. He was from the start of his career. I mean, if he threw in the 90s, it was low 90s. He was just very artful. And, you know, Stan repeated, I think, first grade. And he didn't complete elementary school. And, you know, the knock on him was, he's not that bright. He was a very bright person. When it came to baseball, he remembered things. He didn't make the same mistake. And you have to be that way. So, yes, part of it was his athletic ability and dexterity, because the way you grip the ball has a tremendous effect on how successful you're going to be. And if he swore that he could control the spitball, I mean, there's no reason really to doubt him, because he was a control pitcher. And the other thing was, Steve O'Neill knew how to, we call it, frame the pitch. So when O'Neill caught Kovalevsky, he would catch the ball in such a way that if it was bordered the strike zone, he'd pull the glove in ever so subtly to get him that strike. So that's why I'm saying the catcher and the pitcher work very closely together. Yes, it takes a lot more to be a finesse pitcher than it does a power pitcher.
Let's go back to the beginning of our conversation when we talked about your interest in baseball, but not just baseball as a sport, but in the context of American history. What was going on when Kohei was pitching in terms of baseball and America?
Well, a lot of things are going on. The Roaring 20s were a time of bootlegging. Prohibition was around. You had a young generation, which at once was recklessly carefree. And, you know, the flappers, the speakeasies. It was the first real generation that went to college, the 1920s. And gambling was huge. It was huge at that period of time. And 1919, the year before Kovalevsky won and the Indians won the World Series, you have what's called the Black Sox scandal. And the Black Sox scandal was the Chicago White Sox, who had been the toast of the American League. I mean, they were, without a doubt, the best team in American League, if not in baseball, in the 19-teens. And they threw the World Series. And they threw the World Series because their owner, Charles Comiskey, was cheap. And he reneged on promises that he made to up the salaries of the players. He wouldn't even do their laundry without charging them. So as a result, many of them didn't get their uniforms washed, and that's how they got the name Black Sox. Their socks, which were white, were literally black because they didn't wash them. people think it was because of the scandal. Well, that kind of reinforced it, but it wasn't the reason. So here you have the 1919 Black Sox scandal, and in 1920, a new commissioner comes in, Judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis, to straighten up the game, to end all this gambling. And another thing happens in 1920. The lively ball comes in, meaning that now in the dead ball era, and this is the brilliance of Kovalevsky's career too, because his career started in the dead ball era and it went into the lively ball era, and he was successful in both eras. Not many people who could do that. But the pivot point in the lively ball era was Babe Ruth, because here was Babe Ruth. He started as a pitcher, you know, every fifth day player with the Boston Red Sox. When they found out he could hit home runs, they made him an outfielder so he could play every day. And in 1920, the Yankees pick him up. And there's the rest of history. I mean, the Yankees become the most storied franchise in history because of Babe Ruth and his home run ball. Now, the ball was also wound tighter in 1920, so you had home runs flying out of the park left and right.
Is that the lively ball?
That's the lively ball era. See, in the dead ball era, the ball was heavier, and the strategy of the game was to go base to base. You get a guy on by a walk or a hit by pitch or something, then the next batter, hit and run, you advance them by hit and run or a steal, and then, you know, you sack fly him or bunt him to third base. It's base to base. In the lively ball era, you get a guy on or you don't even get a guy on, you hit a home run, you got to run. And every team in the 1920s, every team, because of Babe Ruth, started trying to get power hitters. So Jimmy Fox was the power hitter for the A's. Hack Wilson was the power hitter for the Chicago Cubs. Ruth started all that. So, you know, it took a lot. It really took a lot to be able to be a pitcher who was successful in both those eras. And I dare say that Kovalevsky was lucky through the spitball because Ruth couldn't handle it, you know, and most of the power hitters couldn't handle it. And he tricked them because virtually every time he would pitch, which you can't do today, you can't go to your mouth when you're standing on a rubber, but he'd go to his mouth before every pitch, you go like this. So they didn't know when the spitball was coming. So he went like this, they figure, oh, I'm going to take the pitch, it's not going to be in the zone, right? So then he'd start him off with a fastball, and he'd get a strike on the first pitch. And that is the trick to pitching. The pitcher has to stay ahead in the count. And the best pitch is that first strike, because you're ahead in the count after that. So that was Kovalevsky's strategy. And it worked very well. For 14 years, it worked very well.
And why is it important to tell his story now? What do we learn in 2026?
I think there's a couple things why his story is important. Number one, for this area. And yes, he was born and raised and pitched at a very different time, but I think the point still holds true. He came from a very impoverished family. They had nothing. And it gives young kids today, regardless what their circumstances are, coming out of a place like Shamokin or Nanticoke or Glen Lyon, you know, a role model, because it gives them hope that they can make it too. You know, you don't have to come from California or Florida where they play baseball year round. If you have a talent and you put in the time and the effort to hone that talent, a scout will find you. So I think for this area, that is what's important for our youth to understand. I think secondly, and what impresses me about Kovalevsky is his humility. Because we just don't have it in Major League Baseball today. There's no humility in the game. There's trash talking in the game. It's a billion-dollar industry, multi-billion-dollar industry, and the players are so egomaniacal that they're signing $300 million contracts. Soto of the Mets makes $700 million, and as soon as he made that, everybody wants to be the highest-paid player. So there's no humility in the game. And I think Stan's example shows us that here's a role model that's not only humble, but he was good year in and year out. Five seasons, he won 20 games or more. And of the other nine seasons he played, most of the others, he won 15 or more. There's no pitcher that does that anymore today. You know, they have a great season. They want to be paid. And then there's no incentive. Kovalevsky had incentive. So a person like this, I think, just reinforces the point that, you know, baseball is lost. I mean, it's lost. It's a game that there is no incentive anymore. It's not played the right way. Very few teams play situational baseball. Everybody wants to strike the batter out or hit a home run and be the hero. And it's a shame. It's not clearly not the game I knew. Clearly not the game he knew.
It's the year of the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence, as we know. And as an historian, just what kinds of thoughts do you have about baseball as you are reflecting on this anniversary?
I have mixed emotions about it. I'm a Philadelphian. The other half of my life was spent in Philadelphia. So I'm a Phillies fan. And of course, 250th anniversary, we have the All-Star game going on, probably in Philadelphia. This year will be the last possible year we could win a World Series with the current group of players that we have because they're aging. So my hope selfishly for the Philadelphia Phillies, especially in this year, is that we finally win a World Series with this group of people. But in terms of the larger game of baseball, the national pastime, my hope is that the game will once again become the national pastime, but for the right reasons, that we have more players like Aaron Judge. Aaron Judge is an individual who should be the face of the game. I mean, I respect Shohei Ohtani as much as anybody else, but sorry, folks, he's not American. Aaron Judge is as American and as all-American as you're going to get. Not a braggart, a very humble individual. He's consistently great. He sets a good example for young people. He sets a good example for the game. He sets a good example for his teammates. And for people up here, we saw him play. He was with the Rail Riders. And very, very interesting story. I have an autistic son. He's now 25. And when he was younger and Judge was playing up here, we had the occasion to go and say hello. And I don't know if Aaron Judge has someone who's autistic in his family or not, but he recognized the autism very quickly. And he asked Ben if he wanted to come and take a seat in the dugout with him. And he did. And that just stole my heart. So I might be a Phillies fan, but Aaron Judge is my favorite player, hands down, in baseball today. And we need more like him. And that's my hope, that we will be a national pastime with players like that.
Dr. William C. Cachetas, born in Wilkes-Barre, he is an American historian, educator, and author known for his expertise in Quaker history, the Underground Railroad, and early American baseball. And he spent time with us here at the WVIA studios speaking about his new biography of pitcher Stan Kovaleski, who came from Shamokin, Pennsylvania. The book is titled Spitballer, Stan Kovaleski and the 1920 Cleveland Indians, and it's issued by the University of Nebraska Press. For more information on the web, nebraskapress.unl.edu, nebraskapress.unl.edu. This was the second of a two-part conversation with Dr. Cachetas, and you can find the first part on the WVIA website. Go to Listen, pull down the menu, and find Art Scene.